This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
Hello, Jennifer, and hello, listeners. Man, I can't wait to get started with today's episode. We have a guest who you would think would be at the end of her career because she's done so much, but she is about to take all of the knowledge that she has and tackle it to something that all of us love. Turtles.
Oh, turtles! So, okay, what problem are we solving today?
How can you save baby sea turtles?
How can you save baby sea turtles? Oh, now this I want to know, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners want to know as well. Who is our guest today, Jeff?
Our guest today is the fantastic Dr. Marcia Tuft, who is currently the principal of Putney Designs, LLC, but in a previous lifelong career as an engineer, she has used her mechanical engineering, aerospace engineering, and materials engineering degrees throughout her lifetime, and now she's going to use it to solve today's problem.
Oh, this sounds so exciting. Welcome to the show, Dr. Marcia.
Thanks, Jen. It's so fun to be back.
We are thrilled to have you back. So when was your last episode on? I'm trying to remember.
It was about how things fail. So it would have been 2021. How do things break and why do we care?
Exactly. And you know what? We've gotten so many downloads from that because, you know, as an engineer or maybe just as a person, you have to learn to deal with how things fail and break, right? Mm-hmm.
And lots of kid listeners, a lot of you, I'm sure, are breaking things. But we were literally just talking with Dr. Marcia before we hit record, and she was explaining a story about a skill that she has that requires breaking something so that she could fix it. Dr. Marcia, could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I think you're talking about some of my hobbies as a kid in elementary school, which was designing stuff, and sewing was always a hobby. And
sewing.
I think a lot of women engineers of my generation grew up sewing because you can't learn to sew without learning to rip. So you have to fail. You've got to learn from your mistakes. And when you have a hobby that you are taking the initiative on, you're learning program management. You're learning, okay, how do I make this, you know, doll outfit? You know, you learn how to put sleeves in, you learn how to make pants. And sometimes you learn things like, oh, corduroy has a nap and it looks funny if you sew it the wrong direction. So then you have to rip and you got it. And then you learn by doing and failing and you build resilience and you learn that, okay, this didn't turn out perfectly. What can I do differently next time? And it builds resilience and confidence in your problem solving skills. And what I shared before we went live was, when I was a sophomore at Purdue University working on my bachelor's in mechanical engineering, I got my first D ever in physics, electricity and magnetism. And for the first time in my life, I didn't know if I had what it took to continue in engineering. And when I thought back, can I do this? Am I creative enough? Do I have the skills? The bedrock that I reached down on was all my creative hobbies from elementary school and later. I knew I was creative. I figured I just had to learn a new medium. And the physics project that won awards in high school, I mean, that was one project. That was a few months of my life. That wasn't enough for me to make a decision on.
Right.
I didn't want to be a quitter, but I just didn't know. I was out of my comfort zone. So all that stuff I did, the artwork, the sewing, the creating, the problem solving, and I didn't think of it as problem solving at the time, but problem-solving skills are the most difficult things to learn, but they're the most transferable across disciplines.
Yes.
And all those hobbies, I was developing my own creative problem-solving skills. And that's what helped me keep going in engineering. Later on, even earning a master's in aerospace and a PhD in materials engineering. So,
wow, that's, and yeah.
I've never regretted sticking it out in engineering. So it's wonderful when you learn to become a problem solver, no matter what your goals are, learning to solve problems can help you achieve the goals in your life. And that's my passion. That's what I love about your podcast. And that's what I try to do with my fiction books.
Well, thanks. Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. I learned how to sew when I was a kid as well, although I probably didn't stick with it as long as you did. I got to the third time that I was like, this didn't turn out the way I wanted. And I was like, I don't think I'm going to be a sewer for the rest of my life. But that's okay. I did learn creativity and so forth. So I want to kind of move that into, okay, you studied three different kinds of engineering. Is it because one passion took you from one to the other, or was it possibly because you just couldn't decide and you liked it all?
Well, so I started working at GE Aviation after my bachelor's. So I actually worked on my master's and my PhD while working full-time at GE Aviation. So they had this wonderful program. It was kind of like co-oping through your master's. So I did different rotational assignments and I was working on my master's at the University of Cincinnati. And then after I finished that, maybe 10 years later, I had an assignment as manager of technical education programs, a 3-year assignment, and I rediscovered my joy of learning. And where I worked was life management, which is kind of how things break and fail and how to establish safe operating limits.
That is,
and so
life.
I have the structural background, but I didn't have the materials piece. So then I went and did the materials piece.
Oh, okay.
So you never, as an engineer, you never stop learning, but sometimes you have a great employer that you can continue your education. And, you know, why not? They paid for my tuition and my books, and it was just my time.
Yeah.
Okay. So having studied those three separate types of engineering, can you give an example of how, for our listeners, how all of those different types of engineers have to work together to either solve a problem or to create a project?
Well, sure. But I think what we're talking about today is how to save baby sea turtles, right?
Yes. Does that give the example of all three of those together?
Well, let me put it this way. So every one of these, you're learning problem-solving skills.
Okay.
So when I was doing research for my fourth book, I wanted to have a sea turtle theme. And I was having problems with plot. And then I thought, well, hey, I'm an engineer. There are real problems out here. So what if I could solve a real problem? And the problem I chose to focus on was how to help save baby sea turtles from becoming misoriented by artificial lights behind the nest.
Okay.
Because if the babies don't make it to the ocean, they don't turn directly to the ocean, they get stranded inland and die when the sun comes up and predators get them.
Right. Okay.
So my background didn't necessarily tie any one of those in a classic sense. But by going to the turtle talks that the marine biologist Amber Kuhn led, I learned the story about what was the source of the problem. So as an engineer, you learn to dig down and say, what's the problem? So she was describing beachfront development increasing. So if you imagine 20, 30 years ago, single-story homes,
right,
the dunes provide enough shelter from the artificial light that the baby sea turtles, when they come out of the nest, out of the sand, they're not distracted by those lights. But now, okay, we have multi-million dollar mansions,
yes,
2- and 3-story highs, multi-story hotels, and huge, you know, beachfront condos. So now the light is coming from a much higher angle. And yes, there are lighting ordinances, but not all homes are in compliance and not all vacationers comply with them. So if the sea turtles see that light, they'll turn in the wrong direction. So as I was listening, I was hearing about, okay, what else do I know? I knew that the sea turtle patrols the beach every morning when the mothers are laying eggs. They mark every nest.
Yes.
So I know they have a physical location. They know when each nest was laid. It goes into their database and they have a very detailed GPS marking. I also learned that about 10 days before the nest hatch, and 60 days is average incubation, about 10 days before, you typically see a bowling ball depression. So there's a just-in-time indication, as well as turtle trackers sea turtle patrol knowing when each nest is about due.
Hold on, I have a question about that. So the bowling ball depression, what does that mean?
So that means there's a depression in the sand. As the babies start breaking through their eggs,
okay,
you know, the sand starts settling down around them as they get out of that egg and some of that airspace filters out.
Okay.
So there's a change in the physical surface of the sand above the nest.
Oh, so you're saying the sand makes a depression kind of that yes. looks like a bowling ball. Oh, okay.
Yeah, so, a small divot, just a small depression.
So if kids see that, I mean, first of all, stay away from the nest. That's why they yes. like put the fences in or whatever around them.
They put three poles up to mark the nest yes. location.
But then you'll know to watch soon.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, and cool. I didn't know that. Now I'm going to go down to the ocean
A safe distance. Stay at least yes. 10 feet away because yes. they can sense the vibrations and they won't come out because they'll think you're a predator. They won't come out if they think if you're too close to the nest. So you got to watch from a safe distance and use only red flashlights, not white flashlights, because white is very sensitive and they're programmed to orient towards the nearest light source. So they'll misorient.
Okay.
So as I was saying, so I knew that there was a just-in-time indicator. And I thought, well, if we're not effective in blocking the light at the source, here's where the story of Stumpy inspired me. So Stumpy is a three-legged, 400-pound mama loggerhead sea turtle that by some miracle got Amber Coon's help to dig her nest. Amber took the place of the missing leg and was able to help her successfully dig the nest.
And the turtle was okay with this? Like,
Amber's a trained marine biologist.
Okay.
She was very careful to approach Stumpy from behind. And it was Stumpy's fourth attempt trying to dig this nest. So once they start digging and Stumpy figured, this is feeling okay. The hole is becoming the right shape. She was able to lay that nest. But 60 days later, all those babies turned inland and died.
Oh.
So hearing that story, I thought, well, what if for my story, what if Stumpy was a character in my story and the challenge was to try to save Stumpy's babies and we had 10 days to come up with a solution? Could we do it?
Okay.
So learning everything I learned from Amber, from those turtle talks, I thought, okay, what if we're saving, not trying to save every nest, but one nest? What could I do differently? Well, one of the things I thought of was I don't have to worry about all, let's say 400 nests on Hilton Head. 13% typically get lost due to misorientation. So that's about
sad.
52 nests. On average, there's 120 eggs per nest. So that's over 6,000 hatchlings lost to lighting. But
it's so sad.
It is. But you can tell from a nest, you can tell which ones are likely to be at risk, because if they're located with coverage from the dunes, then you figure, well, there's a good chance the dunes are going to provide natural coverage. But some of them are out on the flat sand close to paths where there's not an extra layer of dunes, or they're right on a pathway to a boardwalk. Mm-hmm. So you can figure, okay, so maybe 13% of those nests are at risk and I can guess which ones those are. Now add into the other factor, if I know nests that are close to hatching, so I can probably get that 52 nests down to maybe 5 or 10 at a time. So if I can't protect them if I can't turn off the light at the source, maybe I can screen the light at the entrance to the nest. So my first thought from my sewing background and all the totes I make was to use a mesh, like a PVC mesh fabric, because wind's a real problem at the beach.
Yes.
So I figured a mesh screen might block enough of the light, but not be easy to be knocked over from the wind. So there is a little bit of the mechanical engineering background, forces, pressures. Okay, so how do I come up with a solution that'll block the light, that would be tall enough, that would withstand the wind? Now, the first problem I thought of was, my first idea was a PVC frame. And I already know that there's beach abandonment laws. So anything left on the beach after sunset is deemed abandoned property and it's removed. Because so like those pop-up tents, those aren't designed to withstand winds at the beach. And sometimes they get distorted and people leave them because they can't fold them up again.
That's
a hazard turtles. So there are mama sea turtles that they encountered this abandoned property and they turn around because they can't get to a safe place to dig their nest. It can also entrap hatchlings. So I knew it was a non-starter, the PVC frame. I knew it was flimsy. I knew it was a non-starter, but it felt like I was on the right track, a screen close to the nest. And finally, the last day before we were scheduled to leave the island, I had the idea of, what if I could use a structure that was already there? Okay. Now, every beach may be different, but at Hilton Head, Sea Turtle Patrol puts 3 nest poles up. So one's PVC and it has the legal warning signs, and 2 others are bamboo poles. Right. But there's 3 poles. And I thought, what if I could attach a screen to that? Would it be enough that it would be high enough and maybe wide enough to screen the nest and get them going in the right direction? Okay. So this is the day before we're scheduled to leave, and I'm running to the beach to get data. So I have to measure my poles to figure out what the size is.
So with making the screen, I understand the idea completely. Mm-hmm. I have a question about, do scientists know why baby turtles are attracted to artificial light? Because when baby turtles, let's say before humans, there weren't artificial lights, they knew to go towards the water. And there's no lights on the ocean to draw them. So why are they drawn to lights?
Because the moon reflects off the ocean. So at different times of night, if you're out walking the beach at 5 a.m., you'll see moonlight reflecting on the ocean.
Okay. So,
but not always. I mean, you have moon. So what happens on those nights when the baby turtles come out?
Sometimes they get confused. But sometimes they still find their way to the ocean. So, and I just learned last time I was there, somebody said, well, we think they can also hear the ocean waves.
Ah.
So, but if the light is present, that seems to override their other senses.
So the artificial light that we're talking about would be, it's not people, like, it is lights that they're seeing from like the windows of the condos or the buildings or whatever.
Yeah.
Even though a lot of them, because I mean, I've been on some of these resorts and they turn out as many lights as possible as they can. But even you're saying even one small one could potentially attract a turtle.
Yeah. So if you can see it from the beach, it could be an issue. So the area of the beach that I patrol on Hilton Head is north of Dune's House. And there's a lot of residential properties. And there's also a Marriott Inn. And the Marriott has stairwells on the side. And you can see the lights from that stairwell, from the windows in that stairwell, all the way down the beach. And one of the other turtle trackers told me that a lot of babies, if they come out, they see the lights in that stairwell and they'll still orient toward it. So white wavelengths are most sensitive if you have in the red and orange spectrum, because those get absorbed by the water. The babies are not as sensitive to red and orange spectrums of light. So it's the white spectrums that are the biggest problem. So if you read the ordinances, you know, they've got strategies, they've got sea turtle friendly lights that you can put up that are the right wavelength that aren't going to impact the baby sea turtles.
Okay.
But white lights, and there are some houses, they've got cathedral ceilings, they've got walls of glass.
Right.
And they were built before all the ordinances were in. And it's hard to put blackout shades over a wall of glass.
Yes.
And a lot of people, they leave lights on overnight and you can see that from the beach. And it's bright enough to compete with the subtle light of the moon reflecting on the ocean. So that's what we're trying to block.
So back to the screens that you were putting up, can you continue with that? Did that work? Did that solve the problem?
So what happened was I came up with the idea and I figured Velcro ties to attach it to the center screen. And then I got a Zoom call with Amber Kuhn because I wasn't sure how to put it on the side poles. I thought a simple sleeve would be easiest, but they have caution tape around the poles. So instead of going down too far, I thought easiest thing is to get feedback. And I knew anything would have to be approved with Sea Turtle Patrol, Hilton Head, and the Department of Natural Resources. So when I talked to Amber, and we didn't know, you know, if my idea of 36 inches high was going to be tall enough. And I came up with about 27 inch wide length. So it's about 54 to 60 inches wide total. But she agreed to try it. So I made a prototype. It was put on 2 nests successfully. So the prototype we tested last year saved baby sea turtles from 2 nests. So I was so excited
Wow.
that the concept worked and she got a grant and I made 30 new screens for her this season.
Wow.
So wonderful.
They're really, you know, but I was able to come up with an idea late July and get her a prototype in August that she was able to use late in the nesting season and still save two nests. So we had proof of concept.
That's awesome. So again, so this is mesh, which means that it has air holes so that the air can move back and forth.
Yeah.
But so I was going to ask, what color is it? Does it matter?
I like pretty colors, and I had some orange. This year, the nests are blue because that's their color of all their t-shirts and stuff. But I used what I had on hand, and I thought, well, the caution tape is orange, and I thought it would be easier for people to see so they wouldn't stumble upon it.
Sure.
Of course, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, you can't see anything unless you have a flashlight right on it and you get close to it. So you could fall over anything in the middle of the night if you're not watching where you're going. So we talked about color after last year, and we came up with this really pretty royal blue.
Ah, okay.
And I got a light meter. I was thinking, well, can I figure out what light's too bright? And it's like, well, I couldn't get a reasonably priced light meter, but I got a cheap one from Amazon. And I used it to figure out that, hey, I'm reducing the amount of light by 70%.
Wow.
So I figured that's got a shot at making a difference. Because we're just talking about sheltering the entrance of the nest enough that the turtles are going to see the ocean before they get distracted by the bright light behind it. And as I said, we had success on two nests. There was another nest they tried it on, but the eggs were not fertilized. So none of the eggs hatched. You know, you can't do anything about that.
No.
But we had two nests that we had a success. And I'm so excited that we've got even more screens this year, that it's now part of the standard process. And they'll be starting to use the screens now that we're getting into hatching season in July.
Wow.
Very cool. And so we're talking about all this sea turtle stuff. And you even mentioned something that just sparked a big smile inside my brain of sea turtle safe lighting.
Yes.
I can't imagine I'm going to find sea turtle safe lighting in any stores here in Colorado. But it did make me think of, I'm an astronomer, and there are different types of lights that work much better to make a darker sky and a darker neighborhood. So that's just one where that's not a local problem for Colorado, but it's very understandable.
Oh, yeah.
It's a very understandable problem for the light that is bothering your sea turtles. Would yeah. bother me as an amateur astronomer if I was mm-hmm. trying to bring my telescope out there and bring constellations as well. So while I don't live on the ocean and I can't go to the beach and see this, even though I'd love to, I can really understand it when I translate it into my world.
Yeah.
And it's not just a problem for sea turtles, because I read this other children's book, Lundy the Lost Puffin, and that's in Puffins in Iceland. And those birds, they were having the same misorientation problems. So really? Lighting was misoriented. So it's not just sea turtles.
No.
And
light pollution is a really big problem in mm-hmm. cities and all over, and it affects animals of all different kinds. And like, I think if I believe like frogs don't communicate as often and whatever, mm-hmm. like it affects tons of animals. But yeah. I have a question for you. So does the sea turtle patrol, do they watch when they think the turtles are going to hatch? Are they there at night to watch?
No. Sea turtle. So there's two organizations on Hilton Head. There's Sea Turtle Patrol, and then there's Turtle Trackers. So Sea Turtle Patrol gets up. They're on the beach every morning from May through, you know, the end of the hatching season, which runs through like mid-October. They're on the beach at 5 a.m., which means they're up at 4 a.m. So their main focus is to identify the nest and relocate nests that are below the high tide line.
They can relocate a nest?
They can, in the first 24 hours, they can relocate a nest. So if it's below the high tide line and there's repeated washovers, then the eggs won't get enough oxygen to develop.
Okay.
And so the Department of Natural Resources has very specific guidelines. There's a permit holder who is trained and authorized and certified to relocate nests, and they have very strict protocols for how they do that. So their mission is identifying and checking on the nests. So they'll check and see if a hatching has occurred. but they're on the beach every morning.
Okay.
So after babies emerge, you'll get all these tiny little turtle tracks, and then you can see which direction they go. So if they all go to the beach, it's like, hurrah. But turtles are reptiles, and they're cold-blooded, and Hilton Head's pretty hot.
Yes.
So turtle behavior is driven by temperature. So most mothers nest overnight, which is why the artificial lights are a problem. Mothers can become disoriented by artificial lights too.
Okay.
And most babies hatch during the night when it's coolest. So when there's a temperature drop, that triggers them to hatch. So that's why sometimes they can come out during the day if there's a rainstorm or something that cools the temperature.
Oh, okay.
But mostly they emerge overnight, and it can be anything from, you know, early evening to, you know, the wee hours of the morning.
Wow.
So turtle trackers are more likely to be on the beach at night and witness. It's called a boil, because when you get 120 hatchlings coming up, they come out in about, I'm told, about 15 minutes. The whole nest can empty and head to the ocean in about 15 minutes. So it's called a boil.
Yeah, I totally want to see that sometime. That just sounds so cool.
And Turtle Trackers, it's a volunteer organization, and I've joined them. And what we try to do is we put the beach to bed at night. So we'll take a rake and a garbage bag or a trash collection bag, and we'll fill in the holes. Hatchlings can be trapped in trenches. People play these games that have this little C with a dot in the middle, and the trenches are only maybe 3 inches deep or something, but baby turtles can still get trapped in that, and they don't always wash away with the tide. Sand castles can also become a barrier. So our job is to pick up garbage, leave the beach clean, knock over sand castles, fill in holes, trying to make the beach as safe as possible for the babies that may be hatching overnight, and to remove abandoned property and put it near the garbage cans, because there's a contractor that comes by overnight and will pick up abandoned property. So our job is to put the beach to bed. And yeah, we're all turtle fanatics. So we're keeping an eye on the nest, on the areas of the beach we patrol, and we'll keep an eye to see if it's anything close to hatching. And sometimes we'll get the word if there's going to be a boil. But Turtle Trackers are one of the newer organizations. I think they were formed in Hilton Head around 2016. And they're hugely helpful in also answering questions. People on the beach, if they ask questions or want to know more about turtles, but trying to put the beach to bed and leaving it safe and clean and helping our sea turtles thrive.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we've definitely talked some engineering, and this is an amazing problem. One thing I do want to mention for our listeners, Dr. Marcia did just mention that she is a sandcastle kicker overer. We all need to remember that she is doing it for the good of the baby turtles.
And the sandcastles don't get kicked over until close to sunset.
Right.
So
that's the end of the day.
So
the beach
hopefully
to bed.
It's the end of the day and you've had your fun. And, and if there's a kid that's still out there playing with the sandcastle, I'll just ask them if they can help me out by knocking it over before they go.
Nice.
So they can keep playing as long as they want. Just smooth it over when they're done.
Yes.
Nice. So you did mention that a very special turtle was a character in your book.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your book, please?
Sure. So my fiction series is called The Putney Hicks Inventor Adventures. And book 4 is The Sea Turtle Spy Project. So Putney Hicks is a 12-year-old girl. She's in seventh grade, and she dreams of becoming an artist inventor like Leonardo da Vinci. But she's got hobbies like sewing, not tinkering with bikes, and she doesn't see herself as an inventor or an engineer. So the book series is about her discovering her inner creativity and her problem-solving skills and coming up with unique inventions and innovations. So in book 4, the challenge is she finds out that Stumpy, so she's just been transplanted from Kodiak, Alaska to Hilton Head.
Okay.
And this is her fourth week at school.
Right.
So she's struggling with making new friends, and there's a bit of a mean girl that she's coming to terms with. And she hears about this Stumpy, a three-legged turtle, whose babies are due to hatch in less than 10 days. And they're at risk from the porch lights of the house behind the nest.
Wow.
So her mission is to try to find a way to save Stumpy's babies, and the clock is ticking. So like she it. Has, there's a second character in the book who's kind of this cool holographic artificial intelligence, Sam, who's the artificial interface of this otherworldly tech iPad, which gets called a magic iPad, EYE as in magic eye, because it comes up with a magic eye, winking eye logo instead of an Apple logo. And so Sam kind of guides her a little bit through some of the problem solving skills, but then because Sam is so advanced tech and clearly not normal tech, there's two other organizations that are trying to track her down. So that's a fun spy subplot. But so Putney's goal is to do the problem solving process that I came through and see if she can invent this nest. And then the question is, can she do it in time to save Stumpy's babies? Because less than 10 days, you never really know where you are. Those hatchlings really don't send a launch announcement. Hey, we're going to be born tomorrow.
Exactly.
Make sure you got the prototype out.
I've been thinking that this whole time. I'm like, there's no exact date.
It would be helpful, though. Well, I mean, this sounds like it's been, you know, it's a really great book. And I mean, it inspired you to make a real life, you know, solve a problem and change the world with the turtles. But we are getting close to the end of the episode and we need to talk about your challenge because I'm very curious to hear what challenge you might have for our listeners.
Okay, so I realized the ideal challenge would be if everybody could go to the beach, but that's just not realistic.
Poor Jeff.
So if you're on the beach, I have a different challenge for you. But everyone can help with the green cleanup challenge. So litter is a problem for everybody. Mm-hmm. Plastic is particularly. So sea turtles, like leatherbacks, feed on jellyfish.
Right.
And plastic bags floating in the ocean look a lot like jellyfish. So they can get really sick and even die if they eat plastic in the ocean.
Right.
So plastic is finding its way to the ocean. So the green cleanup challenge is to pick a spot like the beach or a park or any place that you want to help beautify. And maybe pick, you know, set a timer, 15 minutes or an hour, grab a friend if you have one, and get some sort of bag to collect garbage in, and then pick up all the garbage and waste that you can find and beautify that space and dispose of it properly.
Yes.
And that's one thing that the story of Stumpy changed my attitude and made me willing to go to the beach and pick up other people's garbage that I was not willing to do before. So story can change attitudes. I'm hoping that my story can change your kids' attitudes about being a tidier citizen of the earth and making a difference by being willing to proactively pick up trash when you see it. Now, I have a special tip. As a longtime dog owner, I'm used to picking up my dog's poop with biodegradable poop bags.
Right.
When I'm patrolling the beach, I have a mesh tote that I made that I can rinse out easily and let it dry. But if I'm just on there for a walk during the day and I don't have my rake with me, I just fold up a couple poop bags and have them in a pocket or my backpack. And if I see litter in the ocean, I just turn it inside out, put it over my hand, and I pick up the litter and I put it in the nearest garbage.
There you go.
Nice.
That's a great tip.
So that's how you become a responsible dog owner, picking up your own poop, and you can just extend that and pick up the other litter that you see without getting your hand gross and full of contaminants or whatever. So that's the green cleanup challenge. And I hope you have fun with that and maybe make it a part of your weekly life that is like, hey, I'm just going to take this little bag with me. And if I see litter, I'm going to take a minute and I'm going to pick it up and throw it away.
That sounds great.
For the artistically inclined, I have a second challenge, which is the sea turtle artwork challenge. I love to paint and draw. So using your favorite media, draw a picture of a sea turtle, come up with a catchy title maybe, and snap a picture and post it to Instagram. And if you would, tag it with the hashtag Putney Sea Turtle Project. So that's where I'm posting some of my sea turtle pictures. And I would love to see the artwork that any of your listeners come up with.
Yep.
So two ways that you can help promote a greener planet and help sea turtles.
Exactly. This sounds great. Well, we hope everybody does those challenge. And don't forget to tag us at KidSolve. Thank you so much for being on the show, Dr. Marcia. It's been wonderful.
Thanks so much, Jennifer. I love this podcast. It's always a lot of fun.
Well, thank you for that.
I'm telling you, when you have that much engineering knowledge and you just look at something that's happening and you realize there is a problem to be solved, how could I use the knowledge that I already have to solve that problem? This episode was made for Solve It for Kids, wasn't it, Jen?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've had Dr. Marcia on before, too, and she's all about solving problems. And this is what we want all of you listeners to understand about how you should approach your life. You can solve a problem, too. Just think of the basics. Sometimes starting with the basics is the best way to do it, in the simplest way, and it actually works, right?
Absolutely. And I'm hoping our listeners will take that and jump right into Dr. Marcia's challenge of cleaning up an environment. You know, the first thing that comes to my mind is that I live in a neighborhood where there's a lot of debris sort of all over the place, and our landscaping company, you know, it's a big neighborhood and they don't take care of it as well as maybe individuals would. So to pick up pine cones and leaves and grass and put the rocks back in the rock formations, when it is clean and orderly, it looks completely different than when it's messy and in disarray.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, we all know I live near the beach, so beach cleanups are great, as are, you know, like you said, cleaning up your neighborhood and all that kind of stuff. The other thing you can do is draw a picture of your favorite sea turtle or animal creature. We would love to see those. And if you want to learn more about Dr. Marcia and her books and see pictures of what she actually created, be sure you check out our website, which is solveforkids.com. And if you have a picture or a comment that you want to share with us, tag us on social media. We are at KidSolve at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
We want to see pictures if you've done any cleanup around where you are. And we want to see your pictures because I want to know who's going to draw a grown-up turtle and who's going to draw some baby turtles.
Exactly.
Until next time, you will hear Jen and Jeff on
Solve It for Kids.